Our interviewees will turn out to have said unreliable things, but it's our job to try and get to the truth. We just need to remember to always do it with balance, fairness, and compassion, but still follow the story wherever it takes us.
I just want to point out, you were right. You told me it would be a hand grenade. You were right. I didn't listen to you.
And now I'm visiting Kevin at his home out in Camarillo. Kevin's hand grenade comment relates to something we'd talked about back in January when this was still a story about social media bullying. Kevin was about to release his statement, and although it wasn't my place to say, I had offered him a warning. It's going to be like setting off a hand grenade, and is that definitely the right thing to do?
Yeah, I think the business might need a hand grenade.
It was a hand grenade in a slightly different way to the way that I anticipated.
Oh, it was the hand grenade I anticipated.
That people would come after you.
Yeah, I knew it. Yeah, 100% I knew it. Because I know this business. I've been doing it 20 years.
I thought the hand grenade would be everybody would sort of just pile in on Jessica Drake and Jackson Wheeler.
When you said hand grenade, I totally thought differently. I knew internally it would be more than a hand grenade. It would be like going to war. That's what happened.
Why? Why is the business like that?
You don't get into this if you're a well-adjusted human being. If everyone was like sane and level, we'd all have different jobs. We can't function like adults. We just can't like be real with each other. Instead, it's just this nastiness.
Our relationship with Kevin these past months has inevitably not been easy. When we began hearing the rumours, we distanced ourselves from him. But once in a while, he would telephone us.
I find it ironic the two of you are together.
Why? Ironic?
Because it kills two birds with one stone. I get to talk to both of you. It's not going to be a pleasant phone call. I'm just going to say my piece.
Sure.
Every day, when I start to feel better, I got to hear your fucking name trying to find out something. Who the fuck are you? Here's the bottom line, John. There's no story.
But today, Kevin says I can ask him anything I like. We're sitting on the sofa underneath a big framed portrait of August. Her ashes are in the bedroom. I can see a lit candle next to them. Her bedroom is purple and covered in stuffed animals. I start by asking Kevin about his childhood.
I can remember being a kid, and one day we're given two options. We could go play soccer outside, or we could go do home ec. The guys all went outside to play with the ball. And I'm like, why would I want to hang out with a bunch of dudes? All the girls are here. I was probably like 10.
I heard that at one point you were going to go into a seminary and become a priest.
When I was a kid, I wanted to, yeah. Yeah, as an altar boy. I was real into it. It was, you know, at a time that it was sort of cool. And then there's sort of the realization, well, this might all be built on a lie.
You know what other world is all built on a lie as well as the church?
What?
Porn.
Absolutely.
I went from
one lie to another.
Yeah. I should describe what this conversation looks like. Lena, Kevin and I are sitting on Kevin's sofa. I have my laptop open. And on my laptop is a list of questions like, why didn't you mention that you checked into a Sheraton the night August went missing? And are you controlling? It's a strange and uncomfortable situation for us all. Okay, let me get to my questions.
Okay.
I feel that we should kind of get to know you more. Like, you're still this sort of slightly distant figure in this story. So I really wanted to sort of...
a distant figure, period.
A distant person.
Yeah. I'm a loner. I've been that way my whole life. I don't know. I don't really like people. I mean, I this is fine. I can have conversations with you two.
It's April 2017. My producer Lena and I are sitting in Kevin's apartment out in Camarillo, talking about his childhood and his life in porn, which began in 1996, the year he graduated college at UMass Amherst. He created a website called Nina's World, which was a live stream of his then girlfriend stripping.
Oh, wow. You guys found that.
Holy shit. We were dating. We were girlfriend and boyfriend. And I started taking photos of her.
And how was she about that? Like, because that's like.
She loved it. She was really into it.
Even though it's like, it's a big step.
Yeah, I don't think so.
I want to tell you what happened in the room just then. When I said, it's a big step, my producer Lena shook her head in disagreement. Kevin noticed, and that's what motivated him to say, yeah, I don't think so.
I shook my head no, just thinking like at the time, the internet probably didn't feel like...
Yeah, like I think it was just, she was sort of like, she didn't get it.
It's a tiny thing. But I think in that moment, Kevin saw an opportunity to side with one of us against the other. I mention it because it's something he's done a few times this year. Like the phone call, during which he told Lena that he wished it was just her interviewing him and not me, because I make him feel uncomfortable and he had had a dream where I was wearing a bathrobe and I was yelling at him and Lena. And then another phone call, where Kevin blamed Lena for asking his colleagues too many questions about him, but he made the point of absolving me.
And what's really weird about this, too, is it's never about you, John. It's always about Lena.
These are, as I say, tiny things. But I can't help noticing that sometimes when Kevin thinks he can create divisions, he goes for it.
I was probably a little girl crazy when I was younger. That's the truth. And, it was easy to find that in porn. Making love to girls in magazines. You know? Definitely me.
Kevin monetized Nina's World, setting up a 1-900 number for fans. It got his foot in the door. By 2000, porn people had begun to notice him hanging around the AVN expos, interviewing porn stars and directors for a fan site he'd created called Stunning Curves. But he proved so professional and likable, industry people started offering him work as a producer. And by the time he met August in 2013, he was established and respected. When I ask him for his earliest memories of their relationship, he says this.
We were sick a lot. We got swine flu in Vegas, and it wrecked our lives. We bonded over that. Then we got the stomach flu a couple months later. Then her appendix burst. I had to pick her up off the floor, take her to the hospital. And then I got shingles in my right cornea. And it was fucking hell on earth. And that fucking woman took care of me like no one else.
But none of those are good stories.
But they are. Because you get through it together. And you have a real connection.
Now, I look down at my list of questions, notes of the terrible things that people have been telling us about Kevin.
I have no skin in this game. Like, I'm just saying to you the things that people have said to me. The thing that people started saying straight away is that you have two previous relationships that have ended in these, you know, tragic ways. One was Shazia Sahari, who ended up institutionalized, and the other was Hunter, who also died.
Yeah, so Kate died. It's coming up. Wait, what's today? Kate died tomorrow. Yeah. Well, fucking 7 years ago.
So Kate is Hunter.
Yeah. We lived together. We broke up in 2009. She died April 13th, 2011.
We tried hard to track down people who knew Hunter, but her family declined our request, and we couldn't find anyone in porn who remembered her well, except for the one ex-boyfriend that Lena managed to get on the phone.
I just kind of want to find out more about Hunter and basically like what you remember about her.
And I think I only dated her maybe five times.
Do you remember what year this was?
Gosh, that's a really good question.
Like, was it right before she died or was it a couple years before she died?
She died.
You don't know that Hunter? Of course you know that Hunter died.
I didn't know that. How did she die?
Huh. Oh, I feel crazy being the one to tell you this.
I got you so good.
Oh, my asshole.
Lena laughed nervously along with his unpleasant joke, pretending that he didn't know that Hunter was dead. But really, it was pretty clear what a jerk he was to do that. Anyway, back to Kevin.
going back to Amna.
Amna, it turns out, is Shazia Sahari's real name.
So you talked to her?
No.
Oh. Amna was institutionalized. Amna and I broke up because of the cultural difference. Well, Amna's Muslim. Like, her mother's, like, real Muslim. Like, wears the whole garments. They say you marry into someone's family. That is a fucking 1,000% true. I was not prepared for what that entailed.
But the porn set gossip is that Shazia disappeared and ended up institutionalized, maybe not due to cultural differences, but because Kevin was just too difficult. Like that story about how Kevin went crazy with his work colleague, Yoshi, for offering Shazia tickets to a Russell Peters comedy show instead of approaching her via him. There's a guy called Yoshi from...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He says basically he innocently...
It's not true.
Gone.
So, this idiot breaks into the records, the model releases, and pulls girls' phone numbers off of it. Not just to my former wife, but to other girls. She calls me. Like, who the fuck is this guy and why is he calling me? I went crazy on him. You are violating the trust of these performers. Where do you get off being a guy who, by the way, his job was a DVD chapter author? He had no business breaking into records.
He said the reason why he contacted, he gave a very specific story as to the reason why he contacted.
Because he's a comedian.
Yeah.
Yoshi's real passion is being a comedian. So what he would do is he would try to get girls to come to comedy shows. So he cold called them. That's what you do? Come on, that's psychotic behavior. You don't just go to model releases and pull phone numbers. That's a violation.
A number of people have called you controlling.
Yeah, I mean, I completely disagree with that. And here's why. If anyone knew the relationship, they know it was the opposite. Mercedes called the shots. I think any man that has a healthy dose of fear of their wife is what makes a good relationship. She ran the relationship. Now, here's partly where that probably comes from. Mercedes had horrible social anxiety. It would affect her sometimes wanting to go to work. It would affect her having friendships. I'd always tell her, blame me. You don't want to go to work, blame me. Fuck them. They want to get mad at me. They're not gonna. They're not gonna call me. They're not gonna say anything to me. That maybe is where it comes from, but if I was controlling, then she wouldn't have gone off to the Snoop Dogg roasts. You know, she wouldn't have done all the things that she did on her own. She did lots of things on her own.
Later, when I listen back to this tape, Kevin's explanation feels frustrating. His blame me turns him from controlling into big-hearted and self-sacrificing. It creates a world where accusations against him are hard to prove. But there were the times that they were seen out together, and August seemed different. Like when her friend and fellow performer Ryan, the man she was texting with the day she died, stood with him on the red carpet at the AVN Awards.
She was quiet. You know, she was like, hi. But she wasn't, come here, giving me a big hug. And it was weird to me that this is a good friend of mine in line and we're like not talking.
Actually, that's not all Ryan told me about that night. His story went on.
And I'm just thinking, like, you got to be kidding me. Like, this is who I wish I was with. And of course, they're right behind you, right? Like a bad movie.
It sounds like you were in love with her.
I loved her very much. I loved her very much. Like, I just wasn't anybody. I mean, it was just nobody I liked more.
Before I take you back to my interview with Kevin, I want to play you a story that Ryan told me. It happened in May 2017, 7 months before August died. She'd attempted suicide and had ended up in the hospital.
And so I had reached out to Kevin. I texted him and I said, this is Ryan McLean. I'm really good friends with August and she's not okay. Can you please like tell me where I could come visit? you know, I want to let her know that I care about her and I want to visit her and let her know that I care about her. And she's got friends and people that love her and that she's okay. And he did not respond to my text message. And instead, he tracked down the person I was with at the time and said, who's Ryan McClain? Why does he know that August is sick? He was mad that I was trying to make sure she was okay.
And did you go and visit her in the hospital?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And by the time you got there, was anybody visiting her? I'm asking Ryan this question because we heard from two people that Kevin didn't arrive at the hospital that day until 7 or 8 hours after August was admitted.
No, the medical staff was there, but there were no visitors.
And how long had she been in hospital for by then?
Before noon, let me put it that way. And I got there at 7 p.m.
And did Kevin turn up?
He did turn up. Her and I were there, and then he did show up when I was there. The nurse said, you know, your husband is here. And she said, yeah, I want to, you know, she wanted to see him. She was very adamant about that. I left. I didn't say hi to him because I did not want to make anything awkward for her.
And what time did he arrive? Do you remember?
I believe it was around 7:35 p.m.
Okay, so her friend Ryan McClain said...
Who wasn't her friend.
Go on.
So in May, Mercedes had a nervous breakdown. She ended up in a hospital. He showed up at the hospital, uninvited. Like, first off, who the fuck does that? Who shows up at a hospital uninvited? She was so freaked out by him showing up. I had been waiting all day to see her. I had 1 hour. I'd been with the doctors all day. I had to have all my stuff searched. I was only allowed to see her for 1 hour. So I show up at the hospital to see her for the 1 hour. He's there, and then he's removed. Someone removed him. Either she did, or the hospital staff did.
If you could only see her for an hour, and you were being, like, kind of searched and everything, how come he just got to walk in?
Well, he probably didn't have anything with him. I brought all kinds of stuff for her. Like, I brought toiletries, clothes. You know, I brought stuff. Mm-hmm. I had also been meeting with the doctors because they wanted to know what was going on in her life. Why did she have this breakdown? We were going over the medication she was prescribed. Also, I want to point out, when she got out of the hospital, she changed her phone number.
For what reason?
Because of these people. Because of that guy.
Ryan McClain.
Yeah.
He said he was on a red carpet at the AVN and he was standing in front of you. And he said that her personality was different. And his implication was she was with you and so she was much more nervous and or much more kind of reserved and quiet.
Mercedes was not reserved or quiet. That is not true. She let me know it. I'm not even sure what the guy looks like, to be quite frank with you. I think he used to be a driver back in the day. I don't recall ever being on a red carpet with him.
What you're saying implies to me that she saw him as a kind of stalker.
She never used that word.
I'm spending a bit of time on the hospital incident because the two stories offer very different versions of Kevin. In Ryan's version, Kevin didn't show up until after 7:30 p.m., perhaps because of thoughtlessness. That even though his happiest memories of their early courtship took place in hospitals and sick beds, a few years into their marriage, and he wasn't so keen to spend time with August in the emergency room. But in Kevin's version, he was prevented from showing up by forces beyond his control, and so August was abandoned to the creeps and stalkers she needed him to protect her from.
She found it very strange that he showed up. She was very uncomfortable with that. That really bothered her.
Did she talk about him in any other scenario?
Nope. Never. Nope. But she was really bothered by him showing up. And then when we got out, she goes, I need to change my number. I can't have these people in my life.
We later do some fact-checking, and now I can untangle some of this. In March 2017, August posted on her Instagram a picture of her and Ryan holding hands at Disneyland. And in the caption, she describes Ryan as one of her best friends. Also, when she was on the Holly Randall podcast, the conversation turned to why she changed her phone number.
Because you had to change your number.
I changed my number a few months ago because I started getting like 50 random calls a day from fucking weird places. And I answered one and I just said like,
hello. Like I try to do like a man voice.
Hello there.
and it was just like a long pause, and they were like, is this August? And I just hung up, and then I blocked all the numbers that were calling me, and I was like, I need to fucking change my number.
And a few weeks after she did change her number, she sent Ryan a text giving him her new number.
No one in the industry was her friend. She would tell me all the time. Think about this for a second. She wouldn't even let me be in a room alone with any of her female friends within the industry. She didn't trust any single one of them.
Now, our conversation turns to December the 4th, 2017, the night August went missing.
I don't understand why you've laid so much blame on Jessica Drake, because after I talked to you, I went back to look at her tweets, mm-hmm. and they seemed pretty innocuous to me.
Sure. I can explain. So it goes deeper than just a tweet. Listen, we can get in this whole thing of how women interact, especially in this business, because there's a toxic element. It's not like how men interact. I get mad at you. I'm like, John, go fuck yourself. You tell me to go fuck myself. We scream at each other, and then it's over. Women don't interact that way.
I should say that I probably wouldn't interact that way.
Yeah, no, I hear you. You know, like, there is a certain dynamic with women that's very different. So I've always said feminism is dead in this business because of the way women treat each other. She's fake. She's fake to the core.
I can only go back to what I said before, which is I went back and looked at her tweets. And, you know, I'm very sensitive to the multitude of malevolent ways that people behave on Twitter. And I know that sometimes the all-out aggressive tweets are sometimes so ridiculous that you just ignore them. But the ones that kind of wrap up a bit of tenderness and kindness in the insults can hurt the most. So I know all of that stuff. But even so, like, I'm staring at Jessica's tweets and I'm thinking, Kevin has on three occasions, to my knowledge, effectively blamed Jessica.
Jessica didn't kill Mercedes. Jessica contributed to a mob mentality. All of this would have ended, John, if someone just had called me. Just said, you know what? I'm really fucking sorry for what I did. I need to change. I need to reevaluate how I handle things. Come on. Come on.
And then I asked Kevin about Marcus Dupree, about why he didn't mention any of that in his statement. Kevin doesn't hesitate. He says,
she came home and I knew immediately something was wrong. She looked white as a ghost. You know, I immediately go into like dad mode. And she just kind of collapsed right here, started crying. And then she told me everything. She said it was really rough and violent, and I fucking lost my mind.
You did?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I went crazy. Like, people talk about me going, okay, that time I did go crazy. Because, you know, no one hurts her.
Why didn't you mention any of that in the statement?
So there's a couple reasons. The first and foremost is I wanted her to go public with it. She got really angry at me and said, no, it's my fault. She kept telling me it was her fault. It's her fault. It's my fault. It's my fault. I mean, it was something like out of a Lifetime movie. You know, she kept blaming herself. I'd be like, and this was when the Harvey Weinstein thing just kind of hit and it was at its height. And I'm like, Mercedes, if you go on about this, the world's going to be at your back. She was adamant. She actually yelled at me. She goes, you have to let this go.
I understand what Kevin's saying, and it's crossed my mind too, that August didn't want to make a big deal of it when she was alive. And so Kevin was just respecting those wishes. But when I met August's brother James in that motel room in Hinton, Alberta, he had a different view.
It's probably impossible, but I mean, can you speculate on how she would feel now that she's gone about the Marcus Dupree story being out in the world?
She'd be happy now that she's gone, right? Now she's gone. She probably, I would assume if she was alive and still living in LA, she wouldn't want that out there. She wouldn't want more fucking eyes on her. Right. But now that she's gone, I'm sure I guarantee that she wouldn't want another girl to feel the way she did.
The next problem is she talked to everyone involved in it and told them, I'm okay. Everything's fine. So then what am I going to do now? People telling me I have control over her. I couldn't control her to like not. I wish I could have.
you know, the problem with you not mentioning it in the statement is that it's led to suspicions about you. People have said, with justification, people have said, how come he's pinning all the blame on Jessica Drake?
When but I'm not pinning the blame. You guys totally have it wrong. She shouldn't have been running XBiz. That's the point of the statement. The statement was for a specific moment in time. She had no business being on that stage, and she has no business being the spokesperson for this industry.
What Kevin means is that Jessica Drake had been booked to present the XBiz Porn Awards a few days after he'd released his statement, and he wanted her to be fired. But even if Kevin had intended his statement to be for just that moment in time, it's still the only page on AugustAmes.com, a domain Kevin controls. And it's the pinned tweet on August's Twitter account. Kevin had worked out her password and posted it there for maximum impact. As it happens, around the time I see Kevin, I visit Jessica Drake to find out if things are getting back to normal for her. And this is what she says.
I talk about this in her room with my therapist with the door closed and a box of tissues on my lap. Like, I'm fucked. Like, emotionally. Now I can walk into a room of people and put myself out in front of these people that I really thought were my friends. That I really thought, like, you know, oh, we're in this industry. We're kind of like a band of outlaws or whatever, but we have each other's backs and we stick together. I'm not a part of it anymore.
You can't take away the fact that my wife said 2 hours before she left to kill herself, Jessica Drake hates me. And I resent the fact that you keep trying to diminish that. And you also don't know the real Jessica Drake. You know the manufactured version. If you sit here and put a microscope on her life, you would find out much worse things. You're going to find a string of dead bodies there too. I'm talking in the more the, you know, yeah, the metaphorical way.
Actually, the only negative thing we ever hear about Jessica Drake is that her social media is a bit holier than thou. But then again, she volunteers with a charity that builds houses in poverty-stricken areas of Cambodia and Tanzania, so there's that. But you did put a lot of emphasis on Jessica Drake on the statement. Mercedes Carrera retweeted Jessica Drake and people were tweeting Mercedes Carrera saying, how can you retweet Jessica Drake? She's the one who murdered August Ames.
But that has nothing to do with me. I never said that. I don't believe that. I believe she's a bully. You're going to keep defending her and it's just going to make me more mad. And that's fine.
Why did you go to the Sheraton Agora Hills that night?
Well, as I told you in the interview, there was no power. There was a fire. So we lost power at about, I'm going to say a little before 10. I had no power. So I realized by midnight I was going to have no phone. Because of the fires, everyone was evacuated. So I had to go all the way to Agora to find a hotel room. That was the closest hotel room I could find. They had one room available.
So what, with the hotels in Camarillo?
No, there's no power. We had no power anywhere. All of Camarillo had no power. So I checked in there, charged up my phone, went back out and looked for her some more. So then the cops called me somewhere between 6:30 and 7 a.m. And I was awake. I would wake up every 45 minutes to an hour and call her a bunch of times.
A lot of this we managed to later verify. An article in the Los Angeles Times about the power outages that night said, quote, many hotels in Camarillo didn't have power, and the ones that did were fully booked. So it does make sense for Kevin to have driven 18 miles to a hotel. Also, Southern California Edison confirms to us that the power at Kevin's address did fail just before 10 p.m., at 9:53 p.m. to be exact. Why didn't you mention the Sheraton to us in the interview or in the statement? Because both the interview and the statement were pretty detailed about what you did that night.
I didn't really think about it. I was only there for a couple hours. You know, I mean, I did say that, like, there was no power, the wind, all that stuff. Never really occurred to me. I mean, there was so much that occurred that night. Seriously, John, it was, like, biblical. I'm sitting there talking to this coroner who's telling me my life's over. And on the TV, like, everything's burning.
I spend 3 hours with Kevin that day. When I ask him if we can do another session soon, he rolls his eyes, but says yes.
A few weeks later, something happens. My producer, Lena, receives a telephone call.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I can't tell you how crazy it is to be talking to you.
I mean, yeah, I do make myself a bit hard to reach.
This is Shazia Sahari.
So then can we say that a week from today we'll see you in Chicago, say in the early afternoon?
Absolutely. I'm actually excited. I got a lot of tea to spill.
In the end, 6 months passed between us first hearing that Kevin once had a wife named Shazia who ended up institutionalized, and the moment Lena managed to get her on the phone. Later in this story, I'll tell you how we tracked her down. It's quite a saga. When we finally do, she asks us to meet her here at an ale house in the Loyola district of Chicago.
Something got triggered in me when August died. I think it wasn't just the visceral nature of her death, because I've tried to hang myself in the past. I felt a connection to her. I felt I understood her hurt. And I felt like, in a weird way, I wish I had kind of just reached out to her and just been like, hey, you know, I'm Kevin's ex-wife, congratulations. But I didn't, you know, like, come on, like, who, you know, contacts their ex's spouse? Yeah. But it broke my heart hearing that, because I could only imagine the hurt she must have been going through.
A few days ago, Shazia emailed Kevin to tell him that we'd made contact and she decided that she would meet us. But she says the email didn't turn out how she'd planned.
I got a little angry, because, you know, once you start typing at first, you know, I'm trying to have class and grace about it. And then, you know, as you're typing, I'm like, oh, I got angrier. But I was just like, you're a piece of shit. I'm so lucky I got away from you. I feel so sad about this beautiful young girl who had the misfortune of meeting you.
What did he say to that?
I didn't give him a chance to respond. And I told him, like, this is the only way you'll be able to reach me. And you better believe this will be deleted, this whole account, within 5 minutes. And that's that.
After Shazia contacted Kevin, he called us to say that she has severe mental illness. Her reality isn't the same as other people's. And if we're expecting a reasonable conversation, it's not going to happen, as she doesn't remember things how they actually were.
I don't know where you guys want to start.
I'm sitting with Shazia Sahari in an ale house in Loyola, her old college district in Chicago. It took us 6 months to find her, and this is how we managed it. Back in 2012, a disgruntled porn actor stole from a Los Angeles STD clinic, a place where porn performers go for routine testing, the real names of 15,000 of them, and then he posted them online. So that's how we first learned Shazia's real name, which is Amna. We had no clue where she might be living. But the Pierre Woodman casting couch video offered a lead.
From which city did you come?
Chicago.
Chicago?
Illinois. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a Midwestern girl.
And so Lena emailed everybody in Illinois with her name. One runs marketing for a halal catering company. Another's entire online presence is dedicated to Hamilton the musical. Neither were her.
They're pretty strict, you know, Muslim family. Ooh, so, yeah, and have a gay brother, so they have their daughter.
And you have a gay brother?
So Lena looked for openly gay Muslim men from Chicago with the same last name. There was only one.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear.
And so she emailed him.
It's just her and I, as far as siblings go. We are very close. There isn't a thing that we don't talk about. And she's like a best friend. She's a beautiful girl, but she's also very sharp, very intelligent, very well-read. If she wasn't my sister, I would still want to know her when she's herself.
Vincent. His name is Vincent. Says that Shazia was diagnosed with schizophreniform, which is a kind of transient schizophrenia. Some sufferers go on to develop full-blown schizophrenia, but for others, the symptoms peak in their 20s and dissipate when they reach their 30s. Shazia is now 33, and Vincent says her symptoms are all behind her, she's a different person. By the way, when Vincent talks about Shazia's mental health problems, he isn't being indiscreet. She's very open about them.
So when she was kind of at the peak of her psychiatric problems is when she made this decision that I want to move to California and I want to work in the adult industry. Mm-hmm. You said you haven't been able to get a hold of her. We talk every few days.
Okay.
I have your number. I will give her your number within the next day or two, and she or I will be in touch.
After that, 10 weeks passed, and we heard nothing. Eventually, an old college boyfriend of Shazia's sent us her new husband's name. Lena emailed him, and a week later, we are sitting with Shazia in the booth of this alehouse, where she starts at the beginning.
The reason I decided to join the industry, in my early 20s, while I was finishing up Loyola, there were some things going on with my family, and long story short, I worked at two different strip clubs. And then while I was doing that, you know, I was exposed to different facets of the industry. And I had actually researched LA Direct.
That's Derek Hay's company.
Yes, I had the misfortune of meeting him.
Derek Hay is the English agent I had talked to over the phone. The man Lisa Ann implied I should be investigating instead of Kevin. Shazia moved to LA, joined his agency, and within days met Kevin on set.
And I was enamored. You know, there was something nerdy about him, something maybe a little dark about him that I gravitated towards.
Like a kind of nerd with a dark side.
Exactly.
But you were kind of attracted to that, obviously.
I was attracted. And I thought he was an attractive man. What made him so attractive was he was well-spoken. He seemed very intelligent, which he is. And yeah, I was enamored. And we had a weird whirlwind of a courtship.
Weird whirlwind of a courtship is not an exaggeration. It all started with her agent, Derek Hay. A few weeks after she moved to LA, she was paid directly for a scene instead of via him. And when Derek Hay found out, he was, she says, furious.
I still have nightmares about the way he yelled at me in public. I mean, I was sitting there sobbing, tears, just sobbing and shaking. And I'm in his office and he's just railing into me. I'm actually on disability for PTSD because I still have nightmares and flashbacks of Derek Hay.
Shazia talks a lot about Derek Hay during our time together. In fact, later on, when the bar starts to play the music too loudly, and so we go outside to talk some more, she feels compelled to bring him up again.
And he's ranted for at least 20 minutes.
Do you remember any of the things that he actually yelled?
I just remember his tone, his icy blue eyes bugging out, and just, like, being overwhelmed. I'm new to this city. Like, I don't have friends. My agent, who says he works for me, is yelling his ass off at me. Like, what the fuck?
All these years later, the image of Derek Hay is burned into Shazia's mind. Whereas when I asked Derek Hay about his memories of Shazia, this is what he said.
I do remember her, but if you ask me specific questions about her, I probably won't be able to answer.
And so, after the incident with Derek Hay, Shazia decided to leave the industry.
Like, I was just so distraught, and I remember calling one of my best friends here, and he's like, we gotta get away from these people, and he sent me a plane ticket home.
She returned to Chicago, but then she had second thoughts and telephoned Kevin to tell him that she was stranded in Chicago, and could he help?
He came to get me, and I looked at him, I was like, hey, you wanna get married? And he's like, yeah. And we went to the courthouse and just got married.
It was just like, hey guys, here I am, and I'm getting married tomorrow. Da 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 da. Like, we were never introduced to Kevin properly. Basically, everybody she knew told her this is probably not the best idea. She wasn't herself. If she had been herself, she would never have gone down that way.
And so, in a panic, Shazia's parents did something desperate.
When we first got married, my family threw me into an institution because they did not want me to marry this person.
Because he was a porn entrepreneur, or was there something else?
Well, he met my parents, and my dad spoke with him nicely. My mom was just sitting there miserable. They were under the impression that he's the one that got me into the industry, you know, and I tried to explain, like, no, I met him after, like. And so, yeah, I was institutionalized then by my family. My parents took me to Northwestern University Hospital, and they put me in cuffs. I was so angry. So it got to a point where, like, before nurse practitioners or doctors would pull me into an office, they'd be like, okay, Anna, can you please promise us you're not going to yell at us? I'm like, I don't know. Depends on what you're going to say.
Eventually, Shazia was released from the institution, and Kevin was waiting for her.
And then when it came time to fly back to L.A., he was kind of like, whoa, what did I do? I remember I was, like, being a bitch about something. And I remember him sitting in the car outside of the hotel, just sobbing, like, full on. I remember I was sitting on a bench, and I had my brother on the phone. I'm like, my new husband's bawling. What do I do? I just let him, like, get it all out. So we moved back to L.A., and almost immediately we became distant. I just started drinking from sunup to sundown, unless I was working. And so pretty much a couple weeks after, we became roommates. Yeah, it was literally like living with a roommate that couldn't care about you. Kevin can be very emotionally distant. And I mean, sometimes not even coming home till 1 or 2.
Was Kevin's emotional distance, was that the worst thing about him, would you say?
I would say his distance was utterly insufferable because we literally barely spoke with one another.
So he was never like physically abusive towards you or anything like that?
No. He was just completely distant. So I'll admit it, I was a raging drunk in L.A. once I realized, like, holy shit, like, what do we do? It was a friend in the fridge because he was gone. I was just depressed. I felt bad about myself. While I was there, I had a suicide attempt. I took a bottle of Tylenol PM with the bottle of vodka.
And how did Kevin sort of deal with that?
Well, he wasn't home. He was never home. And I had contacted a friend of mine in Chicago, and I was, like, crying. And I guess he called Kevin. And, of course, Kevin couldn't be bothered to step away from work. Well, he called the paramedics. And they took me to the hospital. And, you know, you drink that nasty charcoal thing that makes you, so they don't have to pump your stomach. And he didn't show up until, like, late that night when he was done. And then I stayed in the hospital for a few days. And he never came unless he was done with working.
And, like, just sent the paramedics and then just hours went by before he came back.
Yeah. And that, to me, I think was the point where I just started emotionally shutting down as well and getting more into self-destruction.
Of course, as Shazia is telling me the story of her suicide attempt, I'm remembering what August's friend, Ryan, had said about the day in May 2017 when August was admitted to hospital for the same reason. Here's Ryan talking to me about it again in a phone call to me.
What I was picturing in my head was going to the hospital. I was thinking Kevin was going to be there already, obviously. This is how I planned out my head. He was going to ask her, Ryan is here. Do you want to see him for a second? She was going to say yes or no, and I would either see her or I would go home. And what happened was is I went up there, and I sat there, and I waited in this room, and then they brought her in, and she saw me, and she seemed shocked. Her shock at seeing me, I'm sure she was expecting to see Kevin, not me. And that's when she told me that Kevin had not even been to see her yet, which she was visibly upset about, which, you know, to me also means that, you know, she cared about him because obviously she was upset that she had not seen him yet. Like, she was, like, so upset about it that, like, she could barely say it.
But then there was Kevin's version of that day.
I had been waiting all day to see her. I had 1 hour. I'd been with the doctors all day. I had to have all my stuff searched. I was only allowed to see her for 1 hour.
Shazia says that even though Kevin was emotionally distant, he still involved himself in her business. Like the time someone told her that she could make some extra money escorting.
I was told that there are ways that girls supplement their income. He didn't get me into it. He facilitated my entry into it. And he actually drove me to my first client. We were about to make a left turn onto the street where the, you know, date was supposed to be. And for whatever reason, I couldn't tell him, like, I can't do this. No, I don't want to do this. All I said was, oh, I canceled it. And I was just testing to see if you would actually take me there as a husband. And he was just more annoyed that I made him drive down there.
And then there was the question of whether Kevin or Shazia would control who Shazia worked with.
A lot of the people in the industry, he had me put on what's called a no list.
What, Kevin was kind of in control of your no list?
Yes, basically. He told me who to put on there. And honestly, I didn't really question why or what. I just trusted this individual.
He kind of called the shots. Like, she was forbidden to do certain things or to go certain places, or she had to get his permission to drive, for instance. Which is not totally unfair because she also has a history of drunk driving. But there were a lot of things like that. She was a very uncompromising spouse. She's very much about, I am not going to be any man's slave. And it seemed like that's kind of what he wanted or needed her to be.
Slowly, and I felt systematically, just lost who I was. I lost my confidence. And I would honestly go into, like, angry rages, I'll admit. Like, I wasn't an angel to be with by any means. So I can, you know, own up to the fact that I was a shitty spouse, too. You know, after a while, I just started lashing out, too. I'm like, how dare you? I'm in this place where I don't have friends. I don't have family. I only have you. And there was just this profound loneliness I woke up with and went to bed with and was on set with. Although you provided financially, drove me around, the best thing that came out of it, actually one night we had a terrible fight, and then the next day he took me to Long Beach, California to get my Pomeranian, which is, I'd say I'd do it all over again for her.
Was that out of guilt or remorse or wanting to make things better or something?
I feel like it was like, let's give this crazy bitch something to focus on so she's not, like, up my ass about, why aren't you a husband?
Oh, do you remember a man called Yoshi Obayashi?
I'm sorry, can we...
Do you remember a man called Yoshi Obayashi?
I can't say I do.
Okay. Do you remember an occurrence where somebody from Evil Angel phoned you and asked if you wanted tickets to Russell Peters?
Yes, this little kid, yes. I was so excited. I'm like, hell yeah, I love Russell Peters. Are you kidding me? Like, yes, keep my number. And then I mentioned it to Kevin at the time. I'm like, oh, I'm so excited. Like, I'm going to get to go see Russell Peters. He's like, who told you that you could go or some shit like that? And I was like, oh, it was Yoshi or something like that. And he's like, how did he get your information? He must have gone into Evil Angel. What if I was going to come and surprise you with Peter Russell or Russell Peters? And I'm just like, well, one, we both know you weren't. And two, like, I feel like it was part of this, like, Irish Catholic control thing he has going on.
As a reminder, this is what Kevin had said about Shazia and the Russell Peters tickets.
She calls me. Like, who the fuck is this guy and why is he calling me? I went crazy on him. You are violating the trust of these performers.
The fact is, Kevin sometimes remembers things differently than other people. All year I've been wondering, and a lot of porn people have been wondering too, if it's because Kevin is hiding something huge and terrible about August's death. But I'm beginning to think that when he omits inconvenient facts to portray himself in a better light, he isn't concealing a terrible secret, but something smaller and more human and explicable. That he just has some personality traits that he doesn't like about himself.
I think there's a carefully curated facade Kevin likes to maintain. I don't think he was like, go kill yourself, you suck. But, I mean, especially for, you know, a young girl, and especially if you're emotionally a little bit broken, you know, she had kind of a sad backstory, and you marry an older man, and you're like, oh my God, he's going to take care, he's going to love me. And then to feel kind of ignored, I just feel she was very lonely. Because speaking for me, you know, him and my time in LA was the catalyst for some very, very self-destructive behaviors when I was with him and after.
Shazia left Kevin 2 days before their one-year anniversary. She quit porn, moved back to Chicago, entered into a physically abusive relationship, got institutionalized again, and has now remarried.
By the way, did you ever get into ethnographic research in the end?
Yes, I have written academically about it, but I didn't do anything with it, really.
They start to play the music in the ale house too loudly, and so we go outside. Kevin had told us that Shazia has a different sense of reality to other people, and she misremembers things. But she didn't seem that way to me at all. I can't shake the feeling that interviewing Shazia, it's kind of like interviewing August.
I did reach out to Kevin shortly after she died. I was a bit of a bitch about it, I'll admit. I sent him my condolences. Then I'm like, oh, here's a Foxy, my dog. I'm like, oh, here's a picture of Foxy if you want to see. But of course, it was like me looking gorgeous holding my dog. Here's my dog, but look how good I look. I'm like, I'm winning at life. Like, I wish I had known of things other than LA Direct and outside of this like bubble of Kevin and Derek. Because, you know, there are many charismatic, wonderful people in the industry. There are a lot of women that love their work, and I, you know, that's awesome. And I wish I had the privilege of meeting some of these individuals. I didn't.
Later, I tell Shazia that, of course, all year I've been worried about digging around in the life of a grieving husband. Her reply is that you can't ignore the fact of life that some people have difficult personality traits. I mean, if Kevin was here listening to all of this, I mean, I know what he would say, right? He'd say,
I was a lush, it's not true, it's been a few years, my memory is skewed, blah, 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 yeah.
And I cared about her.
I bought her a Pomeranian. It is what it is. The truth is what it is, and everything we've spoken about, I would happily speak on if he was sitting here right next to us. You know, I don't want to speak ill of somebody I once loved so dearly and deeply and who was my entire world, but I can't help it if there's some sketchy things about him that are the truth.
A few weeks pass, and then I get talking with a porn producer I'll call Cynthia.
I think probably it's best to be anonymous. It's hard because, I mean, I even questioned speaking about this because, you know, I had a friendship with him for a number of years. I think I felt compelled to say something just after hearing him just blame Twitter for this thing.
Actually, it's worse than that. He was blaming Jessica Drake.
Which is just absolutely just insane. It's not fair. It's not fair to blame Jessica. It's not even fair to blame Jaxton Wheeler.
That's why Cynthia has decided that she should share with me the theory she's developed about Kevin and his relationships after being around him for years.
I mean, in every relationship that I have been aware of, it has been that there's either been drug addiction, mental health issues, things of that nature. I think he enjoys being around it. I remember speaking about one girl in particular and just telling him I was really surprised that after the way she was on set, that he would pursue her.
What kind of state had she been in?
She was drunk on set and was about to be sent home. She couldn't stand up straight. And she went into the bathroom and you could hear her vomiting. And they were dating within 48 hours.
And do you think that's what motivated Kevin to become interested in her?
I don't know. I mean, she was a beautiful girl and very, very nice. It just seems peculiar. In retrospect, looking back on all of these involvements, it's a common thread.
Are there lots of men like that in the industry, or would you say that Kevin is unusually so?
I mean, he's one of a handful that I know of. You know, initially, I mean, before August passed away, I thought that he just had a savior complex, that he was attracted to women like this because he thought he could help them in some way, which is a common thing in the industry, that, you know, you'll find these men, usually civilian men, that will be drawn to these girls. And that it gives them a feeling of power, and kind of like a god complex or something. They're going to come in and rescue these girls and take them away from this terrible world. But I don't think that there was ever a situation in which he was actively trying to help them change. I mean, it doesn't seem like it.
I know that Kevin would disagree with Cynthia's theory. He's told me about occasions that he drove August to the doctors and to therapy. But Shazia's story shows that his desire to help sick people can definitely have its limits. What seems to happen is that at some point he loses interest. Maybe they become just too broken because he tends to emotionally withdraw from women, it seems.
I just feel like he's never emotionally there.
Cynthia says that when she thinks of the women that Kevin dates and marries, she thinks of baby elephants in the circus.
Especially with August in particular, at least in terms of this business, she was doing about as well as you can. And there was really no signs of the momentum slowing down for her. But she just clearly felt helpless. And it reminded me of elephants when they're babies and they're chained. They feel restrained and stuck. And then when they become adults and they can actually break the chains, they don't, because they don't realize that they actually are powerful and have the power to break away from the chains and trample anyone in their path. And it just made me think of August.
Given that you know everything that we're doing, I'm grateful that you are still happy to let us into your home.
Well, there were times where I wanted to tell you to fuck off. Seriously. I'm not saying that to be mean, but there were times. There were some dark times through this.
The truth is, there were times Kevin basically did tell us to fuck off. Times he told us how sick he was of hearing that we'd been digging around in his life. But it's really worth pointing out that when he did, he often called back within hours to apologize.
Yes, I have been mean to the two of you. I've yelled at both of you.
Well, I mean, we're doing these are unusual circumstances. You're a grieving husband, so every critical thing I say feels like a horrible thing to say.
Right.
Kevin says the reason why he always tries to make amends after things get too heated between us is because of his anxiety.
Anxiety is the great equalizer. I can't be a shitty person all the time. If I were, my anxiety would quickly knock me off my perch. My high horse.
Well, I've always thought of anxiety as a disease of moral goodness.
You're right. Because the minute you do anything bad, like how many times have we argued? And then I'm like, hey, listen, I'm sorry. Somewhere that's tied to the anxiety.
The negative thing that comes up about you is that you have a tendency to be emotionally distant.
Right, which I totally disagree with. I think that came from probably one main person who themselves has a horrible affliction. And that affliction is going to drive people away that even love you. It's just gonna.
You're talking obviously about Shazia Amna.
Yeah, but I don't want to talk about her. I will never say a mean thing about that woman. She's a wonderful person who has a terrible illness.
I found her to be delightful.
She is. She was. It just, she was lost when I was with her. It was rough. I'd never watched someone lose their mind before.
Shazia did say that you controlled her no less. She was pretty adamant about that.
She wasn't performing when we were together. No, she barely shot. Nah. I don't agree with that at all.
She said one thing that was pretty hard. Do you want me to tell you?
Probably not. My response isn't going to be anything because I refuse to speak ill of her. I don't know what's based in reality and what isn't. I mean, she emailed me, you know, when you guys were going to go see her. And I was convinced she was lost again because the email makes no sense. None.
As Kevin doesn't want to know what Shazia said, I changed the subject. There were still some things that I don't understand about the night August went missing. Some things just don't seem quite right. But it turns out that while August's brother James had thought it was suspicious that Kevin could recall the night